and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Republican leaders in Congress have directed the committee that oversees Medicaid to cut $880 billion from the next budget. Cuts to the insurance program for the 72 million poor and disabled Americans will have to be on the menu if House Republicans want to meet their budget goals, the Congressional Budget Office said. But the president of the New York State's largest Medicaid special needs health plan says Medicaid makes tangible differences in people's lives and must be protected. We'll chat with him. Thinking of raising your own chickens to combat high egg prices? You might want to think again. It's not all it's cracked up to be. We'll get the facts from Cordell Cooperative Extension. Plus, the latest episode of Cats Cast reports on a new newspaper for six Catskills towns. And Coach Maggie is here, moving toward health. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Congress has until late Friday night to pass a short-term spending bill to avert a partial shutdown of the federal government. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports a vote in the House is likely today on a bill to fund federal agencies through September.
House Speaker Mike Johnson unveiled a spending bill over the weekend that continues current funding levels for most federal agencies, but boosts money for immigration enforcement and defense programs. If all Democrats vote no, House GOP leaders will need almost all Republicans to support the legislation. President Trump endorsed the measure. If the bill passes the House, Senate Republicans will need support from some Democrats to approve the bill before the midnight deadline on Friday to avoid a shutdown. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, The Capitol.
Stocks opened mixed this morning after a big sell-off yesterday. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 200 points in early trading.
A new survey of small business owners finds their outlook has been rattled in recent weeks. The NFIB's uncertainty index rose to its second highest reading ever. Compared to January, fewer small businesses say now is a good time to expand, but more say they plan to raise prices. Stock in Southwest Airlines took off after the carrier announced plans to join the rest of the pack and start charging for checked bags this summer. Delta shares, on the other hand, descended after the company warned of weaker travel demand. President Trump's trade war is raising electricity bills for 1.5 million power customers in the U.S. who get their kilowatts from Canada. In response to Trump's tariff threats, Ontario has added a tax on electric exports. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Military chiefs from more than 30 European countries are meeting in Paris today. They're talking about forming an international security force to support Ukraine. NPR's Rebecca Rossman reports from Paris. Their goal is to help enforce a possible ceasefire and stop future Russian attacks on Ukraine.
European military leaders are working on a plan for what British Prime Minister Keir Starmer calls a coalition of the willing, a joint force of European and NATO countries aimed at reassuring Ukraine and deterring Russia after a ceasefire. But there's one key NATO member missing from today's talks, the United States. A French official told the Associated Press the U.S. wasn't invited because European nations want to show they can take the lead in securing Ukraine's future. Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and South Korea are tuning in remotely. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Paris.
The military talks in Paris come as Secretary of State Marco Rubio meets with top Ukrainian leaders in Saudi Arabia. They're talking about ways to end the war with Russia. Rubio says he wants to learn if Ukraine is prepared to do difficult things. He says Russia will have to do them, too, to end the war. Ukraine's president is pushing President Trump for U.S. security guarantees. You're listening to NPR. People in Greenland are voting in parliamentary elections today. The self-governing region of Denmark will choose members of the legislature. Greenland's been moving toward independence for several years. But President Trump has been saying he wants the U.S. to take it over, but then says Greenlanders should decide for themselves. Officials in California, Nevada, and Arizona have written to the Trump administration. They're asking officials to examine the future management of the Colorado River. From member station KUNC, Alex Hager reports this comes amid negotiations over how much water the federal government will allocate to each state.
Those states say the previous administration didn't do enough to seriously consider their water management proposal. This letter to Interior Secretary Doug Burgum says states are still working amongst themselves to collaborate on a new plan for sharing water. Michael Cohen, who studies the river with the nonprofit Pacific Institute, says that might not be enough.
There needs to be a clear federal voice calling for all seven states to come to a consensus agreement. And I think the basin states have been successful in the past when they've received that kind of threat. There needs to be this credible threat.
The river supplies tens of millions of people across the West, and the current rules for sharing its water expire in 2026. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Fort Collins, Colorado.
The Trump administration is proposing to end enrollment early for next year's health care plans covered by the Affordable Care Act. Government officials would cut the enrollment period by one full month. People who want to sign up for the health care plans would need to do so by December 15th. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Three prominent members of the ultra-conservative House Freedom Caucus are appealing to fellow Republicans not to get in the way of making massive cuts to Medicaid, likely necessary for financing the party line bill to enact broad swaths of President Donald Trump's domestic agenda, according to reporting by Politico. In an op-ed for Fox News on Monday, Freedom Caucus Chair Andy Harris and members Chip Roy and Eric Burleson argued they aren't calling for massive cuts to the safety net health insurance program, but rather reforms that would, quote, reverse its explosive expansion, end quote, that has left Medicaid, quote, unsustainable, end quote. In his own op-ed for the USA Today Network, titled Medicaid is Vital to New York and the U.S., It Must Be Protected, Doug Wirth, the president and CEO of AmidaCare, New York State's largest Medicaid special needs health plan, shared his personal experiences with Medicaid and shared his broader views on its importance as well as the policy implications and advocacy for protecting the program. Wirth also serves on the Association of Community Affiliated Plans Board of Directors, where he chairs their Medicaid committee. And Doug Wirth joins us now this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
In your column, in your op-ed, you emphasize that Medicaid's a lifeline for Americans of all ages. Let's remind people why you believe Medicaid is so essential, especially for vulnerable populations.
Well, it's really a promise to rural and suburban, urban families, children of every race and ethnicity, adults with complex medical and behavioral health conditions, and older adults. Our elders, our parents, and our grandparents, the program serves all of those folks. So no community in America is untouched by Medicaid's impact.
How would proposed cuts to Medicaid directly affect these groups?
Well, you know, the proposal is to cut about $880 billion, nearly $900 billion from the program. Even the proposal to restrict the enrollment period for expanded healthcare coverage. In New York, we've got about 7 million folks enrolled in Medicaid, 2.9 million older adults. One in four in the ages of 19 to 24, about half of the births in New York are supported by Medicaid coverage, 5 in 8 nursing home residents. So, you know, this is will have a huge impact. For example, Sullivan County alone, there's nearly 29,000 Medicaid enrollees, and lots of folks are working adults, people who work in small businesses that don't provide health insurance coverage. So services, eligibility, health care coverage will go down. That means families will be responsible for health care costs, driving them further into poverty, or people will go without care, get sick, and end up in more costly forms of care, hospitals and nursing homes.
What's your response to those Freedom Caucus members that I mentioned in the intro, who say they aren't calling for massive cuts? They're saying that they're looking for reforms, that Medicaid is, quote, unsustainable.
I mean, I have not seen any reform proposals. They're upset because of Medicaid expansion. Now, let's talk a little bit about the traditional Medicaid population is kids, elders, adults with chronic conditions. But there's also a Children's Health Plus program that's all focused on children. The expansion population, the attack of the Affordable Care Act, is really about attacking healthcare for working adults who don't have access to employer-sponsored health programs. Those are small businesses in our communities. Small business is the backbone of the American economy. So let's be clear, the attack on Medicaid is singly focused on gutting dollars from the program to transfer wealth through the form of tax credits to billionaires, the top 3-5% of Americans. That, to me, is un-American. We need to take care of each other, provide health insurance that supports families and supports people working in small business. It makes no sense.
And we don't know exactly how they say they'll change the program. They're just saying that they're going to make these large cuts, or not say they're going to make the large cuts, however they're framing it. But most Medicaid money goes to states. So really this is cutting what goes into state budgets. How does that affect, you know, states like New York?
Well, there are huge repercussions of federal Medicaid cuts, right? So I told you and the listeners, 7 million New Yorkers, right? So 2.9 million of those are adults that are enrolled under the Medicaid expansion, right? Those are folks who are working people who don't have health insurance coverage. The repercussion is that New York either then has to raise additional funds to cover the loss of those federal dollars, or they're going to restrict eligibility, meaning fewer New Yorkers will have health insurance, or they're going to restrict benefits, which are not good because those are things like primary care visits, behavioral health visits, getting lab work to monitor diabetes and hypertension. So none of this makes sense. If you're committed to a strong economy, if you want lower taxes in New York, then you support the federal Medicaid program and the dollars that New York contributes to the federal treasury through our taxes coming back to New York to serve New Yorkers.
You mentioned in the opinion piece that some people view Medicaid as a handout. Why do you think that framing is misleading and harmful, and how do you see Medicaid as a social contract?
Great question. So, you know, I grew up, I had a mother who was a third generation union organizer, and I had a father that was a small town banker. So our family was essentially, by all purposes, truly middle class. And what I can tell you as an adult son with a mom who lived into her 80s, Medicaid that I never thought would be needed for my family suddenly became vital. In her final years, I mean, Medicaid provided the support so that she could have the kind of care and services, including assisted living. Now, you know, these stories are echoed in communities all across the state of New York and every state in the country. Personally, I don't know anyone in my age group that isn't grappling with some of the same types of health and financial concerns of caring for an aging parent. So when policymakers talk about slashing Medicaid, in my view, they're talking about pulling the rug out from families like mine, jeopardizing the health and the financial stability of millions of Americans and millions of New Yorkers. It's not sound public policy, and it's a violation of a public contract between our government and our citizens to provide access to health care so that people can work, people can live in their home, and our aging parents and grandparents are safe.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Doug Wirth, President and CEO of Amida Care, New York State's largest Medicaid special needs health plan. He wrote an op-ed for the USA Today Network titled, "Medicaid is Vital to New York and the U.S. It Must Be Protected." You mentioned your personal experience there with your mother. You have experience working with underserved populations such as veterans and those affected by HIV/AIDS. How have you seen Medicaid make a tangible difference in people's lives in those populations?
Well, I, you know, in Wisconsin, before I came to New York, I ran 5 homeless shelters in Green Bay. And, you know, people who are homeless often go without health care. One of the problems about people going without health care is then they get sick and they end up in hospital emergency rooms. They get admitted. And so Medicaid is a significant payer for healthcare that provides veterans and other vulnerable Americans with access to primary medical care and services that prevents them from getting really sick and going into the emergency room. Medicaid, in terms of caring for people living with HIV, is the largest payer. About 85% of adults living with HIV will require access to Medicaid during their lifetime. And we've made significant advancements in New York to ending the HIV epidemic by getting people on treatment so that their virus, the HIV virus, is undetectable, it's untransmittable. We're very close to game-changing results of ending the HIV epidemic in New York. But if the federal government cuts Medicaid and the state pulls back the Medicaid program, our progress will be reversed. And that will be truly tragic.
As a healthcare leader or Medicaid advocate, what kinds of actions or policies would you advocate for just to strengthen the program rather than dismantle it?
I think that New York State is a Department of Health, for example, regulates Medicaid. They deal with health plans. There are very strict rules about who becomes eligible. And so, you know, I don't see the waste that is sort of part of the national debate. I think lawmakers, our governor, our health department, they all stand ready to strengthen the Medicaid program. But you're not strengthening the Medicaid program by pulling out $880 billion. That's gutting the program. Make no mistake.
You touched on this a little bit earlier, but what does the stability of Medicaid mean for the overall health of the nation and the healthcare system in the country?
Well, in the U.S., about 80 million people, 80 million Americans, that's children, mothers, individuals with disabilities, folks who work with low incomes, depend on this program. Medicaid is us. Medicaid is the U.S. Medicaid provides the coverage for people who need that health care so they can work. Work requirements have proven to be costly and ineffective. I mean, most people who have access to the expansion exchange programs through the Affordable Care Act, they're already working. So, you know, what we really need to focus on, and I think, you know, there's a new survey out by the Kaiser Family Foundation that actually documents that over 60% of Republicans, even voters who supported Trump, say Medicaid is very important to their local communities. So I think, you know, folks in Washington need to listen to the American people. The Medicaid program is us. The Medicaid program is a backbone in the United States to supporting kids, mothers, and working adults.
How can everyday citizens advocate for its protection and support and get that message to Washington? What can we do to ensure its future?
Well, there are lots of folks, I think, within WJFF's listening area who could contact their local congressional leader. Mike Lawler, who represents New York's 17th district, there's over 238,000 people in his district who rely on Medicaid, and over 77,000 in the expansion program. New York 18, Pat Ryan, 273,000 residents in his district rely on Medicaid. And New York 19, Josh Riley, there's about 277,000 folks in his district. People should contact their congressional leader and let them know that Medicaid is important to them, to their community, and ultimately should be important to those congressional representatives from New York.
Finally, if you could leave lawmakers who are debating this in Washington and just listeners as well with one key message about Medicaid, what would that be?
Medicaid is a lifeline for all Americans. Don't gut the program, protect the program, and support Americans in being healthy, well, and able to work.
That's Doug Wirth, president and CEO of Amida Care, New York State's largest Medicaid special needs health plan. He shared his personal experiences with Medicare and shared his broader views of its importance in an op-ed for the USA Today Network titled "Medicaid is Vital to New York and the U.S. It Must Be Protected." More information about Amida Care at amidacareny.org. Doug Wirth, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tim. It's been great being with you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, information about what to do if you're thinking about raising your own chickens. There's more to it than you might think. We'll take a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale. Dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
I'm Mimi Bradley, Radio Catskills Development Manager, reminding you that a great way to keep public radio here in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania is by becoming a Sound Supporter. Sound Supporters give small amounts, $20, $30, $50 a month or more, that add up to a big help. Plus, Sound Supporters get special thank yous, like drawings for tickets to events in our community throughout the year. Become a Sound Supporter. Go to WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Recently, Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins offered some unusual advice to Americans frustrated by rising egg prices. Raise your own chickens. Egg prices have reached record highs in recent weeks, with some areas of the U.S. seeing a dozen go for $10 or higher. Much of the price jumps have been blamed on bird flu outbreaks, which have killed millions of chickens and caused poultry producers to kill millions more to stop the spread of the infection. As the spread of avian influenza continues to accelerate across the country, including here in New York State and Pennsylvania, concerns surrounding the health of poultry populations are at an all-time high. The Cornell Livestock Program Work Team has an upcoming webinar aimed at helping folks make informed decisions about raising laying hens and managing potential disease risks. It's called Raising Laying Hens for Eggs. Is it all it's cracked up to be? I spoke to Michelle Prosha, Cornell Cooperative Extension, Sullivan County, about the virtual session.
So we're getting a lot of questions these days about poultry. Obviously, you know, folks are going into the grocery store and seeing those those big, big numbers, right? We have to make some decisions when buying eggs these days. So, you know, again, we've been getting a lot of calls about folks interested in raising their own birds versus buying, you know, eggs from the grocery store. And it's a great question. So what we did is we worked together with the Cornell Livestock Program Work Team, which is a statewide work team. So we have educators from across the state. We're going to have myself, Amy Barkley from Western New York, Rachel Moody from Northern New York, and Nancy Glazier from the Central New York area. And we're all going to be going ahead and speaking on the different regulations, how to own. I'm going to be doing a budget on what it actually costs to be raising these poultry. So you'll really know if it's worth it with your time and you have that money for that budget. So it's going to be a great program. I encourage everybody to go ahead and register. And if you can't get in because it is full, I'm not sure yet, but we will be recording it and we can send that out as well.
What are some of the most common mistakes people make when they're starting out with a small flock of laying hens? Is it budget? Is it understanding that?
I think a good portion of it is budget, you know, just knowing what you're getting into. I mean, it's the same with, you know, if you buy a puppy or a kitten, right? You know, there's just those incurring costs and you know, poultry and birds are no different than those dogs and cats. You know, they got to be fed every day, got to be taken care of every day, no matter the weather, time of year. Some other things that, we're going to discuss, you know, when you're purchasing those chickens early on, chances are that you're going to have to purchase a minimum of 6. So things to know like that, if that is even allowed on your property, we're going to talk about zoning, a lot of different things. So
I think maybe folks may not know that thinking you could get 1 or 2, but nope, you've got to get a minimum of half a dozen, for a dozen, so to speak. Are there any particular health or safety concerns that residents should keep in mind when they're raising chickens?
Obviously, right now in the news, we've been discussing a lot of avian flu. That is our big, big topic that we're also going to discuss. Obviously, our job as educators is to try and let folks know about the diseases that can happen with poultry, but to also educate them on biosecurity, which is really, really big when you are raising not only farm animals, but especially poultry with the climate that we have with avian flu.
Do you raise your own chickens and hens?
I have in the past. Yes, I like to say that I'm retired now. I've given up the winter watering. So, but yes, I have raised a lot of meat birds, poultry, eggs. So I'm familiar with that. My background is a lot of hands-on small poultry, which is what a good portion of our county is dealing with as well.
What was one of the most rewarding parts about having your own hens and chickens when you were doing it before you retired?
You know, I think the community that you get from being a farmer and, you know, that kinship you get from going to the farmers markets and working with other farmers and working with your customers. And of course, you know, you love your animals at the end of the day. So you kind of gain that relationship as well. So we wanted to make folks have a good basis for if they do decide to raise these animals with all the information that they have and that they were given, at least they can make a well-rounded decision by the end of it.
Do you have any unexpected stories that might surprise some aspiring flock owners about your time raising those animals?
Oh, sure. This was, and I'll try to keep it brief for you. this was many years back when we had one of those Arctic blasts during the winter. And I mean, it was negative 30, you know, and it was windy. And I had been putting these chickens in the barn to try and get them out of the wind. And, you know, every couple minutes I'd come back outside, check on the fences, and all the chickens that I had brought inside in this freezing cold are now back outside just hanging out in the fences. So, you know what? They got to do what they wanted to do that night.
They didn't mind the cold, I guess.
No, they made their own decisions. So,
all right. So that is coming up, the workshop, the virtual program, actually, Raising Laying Hens for Eggs. Is it all it's cracked up to be? Tuesday, March 11th at 6:30 via Zoom. You also have an upcoming event for CCE, a fundraiser, which is important to your funding for keeping these programs going.
Yes, this is going to be awesome. I'm very excited. We are reopening up our kind of cooking series. So this is the first event we've had in a long time. And it's also a fundraiser for our Sullivan Fresh program. So what we're going to do is have a cooking series with Chef Aaron. That's going to be on March 13th from 6 to 7:30 at our office. And Chef Aaron is going to discuss kind of what's in season and what farm fresh products you can use to make your dinner with. So it's going to be great to incorporate the products that we get from our local farmers into our cooking series and have that all be a fundraiser to support that program.
And where can folks get more information about that and all of the programs at Cornell Cooperative Extension, Sullivan County?
They can register and view all of the information at sullivancce.org under our events page. Go there.
That's Michelle Procia from Cornell Cooperative Extension, Sullivan County. Thank you so much.
Welcome. Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, a new nonprofit newspaper, The Overlook. It's featured in the latest episode of Cats Cast. We'll speak to host and producer Brett Berry next. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
You're back with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Overlook, a new nonprofit newspaper, describes itself as community journalism serving Hunter, Hurley, Olive, Saugerties, Shandaken, and Woodstock. At a time when newspapers in America are disappearing at a rate of about 2.5 per week, The Overlook is attempting to buck that trend with community coverage and investigative reporting served up weekly in a free subscription model. On the latest episode of Cats Cast, host Brett Berry looks at this promising new publication. Brett's here. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. How are you?
Oh, good. And this is even better that there's a new newspaper around. I'm excited when there's new journalism that's popping up, especially here in our corner of the world. Tell us a little bit more about the Overlook and that coverage area where they have where coverage has been kind of sparse.
Yeah, I mean, I think last time we spoke, we talked about cellular deserts, and now we're talking about news deserts, and this is filling a void that people were really missing community news in these communities that you just mentioned. And so this is a weekly newspaper, which is delivered online for now, maybe real paper in the future, but I don't know. And it's based on a nonprofit model and is free to receive. There's never going to be a paywall or anything like that, is what I was told. So it's available for all the residents of this area in kind of the central Catskills, the Overlook.
Wow, that's great to hear, especially in the world of these corporate owners charging more for every which way to look at news and information, I think. So what are we going to hear in this clip from the latest episode of Cats Cast?
Yeah, so I met with the inaugural editor-in-chief, Noah Eckstein, a young guy who has lots of journalism experience. And he's recently moved up to the area and has taken the helm of this new publication out of a small studio space in Woodstock, which has a little history of its own, which you'll hear about in this piece, some interesting rock history happening in that room. So that's kind of neat. And just kind of getting a sense from Noah of what this is all about and the direction he's trying to take. And so I think it's all there.
why he's taking this big leap. Right. Here's Brett Berry, the latest episode of Cats Cast, taking a look at the new nonprofit newspaper, The Overlook. Thanks, Brett.
Thanks, Tim.
I'm Noah Eckstein, chief of The Overlook, which is a new nonprofit news outlet that serves Woodstock, Saugerties, Hunter, Hurley, Shandaken, and Olive. And right now we are in Woodstock, New York, at the old Bob Dylan White Room, which supposedly, according to folklore of this place, Bob Dylan wrote Masters of War, Mr. Tambourine Man, and many other songs. He was living in Woodstock for a while, and he rented this space to get away from his young family to write.
This very room.
This very room. Yes. Sometimes I like to conjure the spirit of him, but I'm reminded that he's not dead.
Maybe he'll stop in.
Yeah. I'm sure that
that you did.
So tell me about this new venture, Overlook. How did it come about and who's behind it?
So Overlook is a nonprofit news outlet. It started when Scott Widmeyer and Jackie Callahan got together. Jackie is co-owner of the Golden Notebook bookstore. Scott has lived here for over 15 years, and he comes from communications and was deputy press secretary to Jimmy Carter's second campaign. And they came together and realized that this area, the Overlook region, these six towns were not receiving robust coverage when it comes to just journalism and local governance coverage. They formed a board and they held focus groups to really understand what was missing, what people wanted. And they then hired me. I came on board part-time in October of 24, full-time at the beginning of 2025. We launched in February 13th, and we're going as a weekly. So our board is mainly concerned with, you know, just overseeing the nonprofit, overseeing what we do and fundraising. And so, yeah, these are just a group of people, community stakeholders, leaders who are coming together trying to put their efforts and resources and money behind local journalism.
So you mentioned six communities: Hunter, Hurley, Olive, Saugerties, Shandaken, and Woodstock.
Yep.
How were those towns identified as places that needed local journalism presence?
I think a lot of that came from the early focus groups that Jackie and Scott held with the communities. And it was also a conscious effort on where we could make the most impact. It's sort of this idea of the Overlook region, you know, standing on top of Overlook Mountain, looking around, what do you see? Right now, this is like where we really see we can make the most difference and connect these communities to each other in a deeper way. We're trying to build a team that can provide consistent, robust coverage that is really holding the powerful to account and ensuring that we're meeting that First Amendment, Fourth Estate role that journalism, you know, is for.
Not a lot of investigative journalism in the Catskills. Is that something that sets you apart?
As we grow, I think our lane could very well be investigative when it comes to the news. I'm trying to move us away from minute coverage of meetings. So if a zoning board meeting might not require a 600-word story, but it could be a truncated, distilled version of what happens in 100 words, then just having a journalist go there, they are building connections, having interviews for something that is a longer-term story.
So right now it's updated once a week. How do readers access it?
Readers can access The Overlook at www.theoverlooknews.com. If you scroll to the bottom of the page, you can subscribe. It's free to receive. We also have Instagram, Facebook, and Blue Sky at The Overlook News, which we post sort of the biggest stories of the week, and we'll continue growing those platforms as sort of a more of a back and forth between what we're doing and the audience.
The Overlook was organized as a nonprofit. What are the benefits of that structure, and particularly for a news outlet? Is that unique?
In 2020, Northwestern University did a study that said quite famously in the journalism industry that two newspapers were dying per week in the United States. That number, most recently, they updated it in 2024 to 2.4 newspapers. So the idea that a newspaper could be a nonprofit has sort of formed as a resilient model, particularly with this umbrella organization called the Institute of Nonprofit News, which currently is our fiscal sponsor. They provide insurance, lawyers, a community of people to bounce ideas off of, discounts on health insurance and payroll. They really help news startups get started. And eventually, in the next 6 to 8 months, we'll be our own incorporated nonprofit, but still considered under the umbrella of INN. So now that we've started publishing, we're applying to grants. There's a lot of foundation grants. There's reporting-specific grants. So, for example, the Shady Dump, as it's colloquially known around here, that story, is an environmental story that we could apply to some environmental reporting grants to cover that story.
That's a lot of work to find story-specific grants.
Yes, yes. So that's a big part of my job at this point, is delegating, is finding people who can spearhead some of that work. But I have a lot of experience in grant writing as well.
Why is local journalism in such dire straits? What's changed? And how does the nonprofit structure protect you against those factors?
So, yeah, okay. Well, I'll start with the first part of the question. What's changed? It used to be every town had a local paper. It was dropped off at the corner store. It was dropped off, you know, on your driveway. There was a local paper. The national paper got dropped off. And that was the source of truth. That was before social media, before the internet. That is what people really clung to stay in the know of what was going on. So much has changed with social media, particularly with millennials and Gen Z. I don't know a Gen Zer who is subscribing. I'm sure they're out there, but largely from what I'm seeing on social media is Gen Z is not subscribing to paid news. There's so much content online that it's overwhelming, and young people feel satiated in terms of what they need to know based on the few paragraphs of news that they get accompanied to a photo on social media.
I know a lot of older people who aren't going to pay for news either, which is unfortunate, but go ahead.
Would you say that those people were people who used to have subscriptions to newspapers and would read print?
Yes. And then there are, you know, traditional online components of newspapers that have paywalls that a lot of people refuse to get through that paywall. They would rather just read the headline and see if anybody else could summarize it for them, which is unfortunate because obviously everything costs money. Journalism's not cheap.
Yeah.
Sending people out in the field and paying their salaries.
Sure. And I get it. People are busy. They have a lot that's going on in their lives. Things are not easy. And a lot of times national headlines can seem so jarring and scary that it makes people, for their own mental health, want to shut that off.
And also, years ago, you had your one or two newspapers. Now, through social media, you see headlines from newspapers all over the country. So, no, I probably don't want to pay for a subscription for every newspaper headline that I see online just to read that article.
Exactly.
Something comes through from the Washington Post. I don't know if I want to subscribe. It's not my community.
Yeah.
So we're exposed to more news than we would have before, more options, more opportunities, but to subscribe to all of those would be ridiculous as well.
Yeah. But that's one thing with the Overlook. We are free. We, you know, completely plan to remain free with no paywall, which I think is huge. There's no barrier to accessing what we do. And we're finding ways to include younger people in the creation of the news. We have, who will be joining us soon, a high school correspondent who will be our eyes and ears in high schools. They're the next generation of journalists and of active citizens. And there's so many interesting national news stories that affect local kids in our area. One of them is when TikTok was banned and shut down for like 36 hours. A lot of young people went over to a social media called Red Note,
right?
And they're still on it. And what does that mean? What does that mean for kids at Onteora? So yeah, we're trying to find ways for young people to be included and for us to also make the Overlook something that young people want to read and go to as something that they view as critical for their news diet.
Was it difficult to find reporters to cover this area?
Yes. We're still actively interviewing and talking to reporters. A big part of my job right now is trying to convince retired journalists who live in this area to write a story a month, do an investigative piece, an environmental piece. There's a lot of younger people who are interested, but with a new startup, with young people, it sometimes takes a lot of editing and mentorship and guidance, which I'm very open to. But with the weekly schedule, it becomes a little difficult as we're building our team. So anyone who's listening to this who wants to contribute, please reach out.
So you, as the founding editor-in-chief, are shepherding these stories.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about your background in journalism and how you found yourself here.
Yeah, so I grew up in New Jersey. I always wanted to be a journalist. My grandmother was a refugee of the Spanish Civil War and came to this country and started cleaning apartments in New York City. And she remembers hearing Edward R. Murrow on the radio. And that's how she learned to speak English. And she always instilled in me a desire to tell stories. That telling stories is a way for people to recognize a deeper, compassionate version of humanity.
Many kept coming up to speak to me and to touch me. Professors from Poland, doctors from Vienna, men from all Europe, men from the countries that made America.
So from the time that I was like 12 years old, I knew I wanted to be a journalist. And when I went to high school, I started a weekly news program on our high school TV station called Noah's Noggin, which was very, very fun to produce, and kids loved it, and I would have people on, and we would have interviews.
That high school news show also helped put Noah on a path of investigative inquiry that serves as a guidepost for The Overlook.
Yeah, so Noah's Noggin was quite controversial in the town that I grew up in Kinnelon, New Jersey, which was a small, very white, conservative town. And so I would bring on students with disparate viewpoints to share their thoughts in the spirit of journalism. But I once had on the three Muslim students who were in the school who refused to say the Pledge of Allegiance. I had them on, and the school vice principal and principal ran up to the recording studio and stepped in front of the camera and didn't allow that to get aired, which always stuck with me, and it still sticks with me in terms of the fact that good journalism and journalism that seeks a diversity of perspectives, sometimes people don't want that, but that is even more reason why it's important to protect the First Amendment, freedom of the press, and to do our job. I went to college in the UK. I did my undergrad and master's in London, studied journalism and US history to get an international perspective on US coverage and US journalism. And yeah, after that, I worked for a bunch of different places, Semaphore, regional outlets, the Daily News in the city, New York Times. And then during the pandemic, my partner and I moved to the Hudson Valley and just have been working and living up here as journalists. And this is a dream come true for me. I mean, to run a news outlet with a team of people that are so thoughtful and compassionate and really looking to make a difference, the bones and the structure for sustainability and deep impact are there. To be a part of something that's so fresh and so exciting and forward-looking and trying to make a real difference in community is really a dream come true for me.
Are you concerned at all that being based kind of in the heart of Woodstock, that Woodstock will drive most of the journalism? What kind of efforts are you making to make sure that those other five towns that are in your mission are covered adequately? Because there's always a lot of news in Woodstock, I feel. But, you know, as you said, those other five towns need coverage.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're doing a good job already of sort of spreading out coverage. But it's a matter of continuing to cultivate dedicated writers who can cover the towns. But we also have to cover the bases with Woodstock and Socrates. I mean, we're looking at it as trying to cover it all at the same time, but until we bring on more writers, mm-hmm. we have to focus on Woodstock. As we grow, you know, I'm very interested in partnering with the historical societies in each of these towns to produce interesting historical features of what came before. Because a lot of times people who move into these towns, they don't know so much the history of what has happened and their sense of place within the community where they're entering it. So I think the Overlook can help with ensuring that new neighbors just understand what's going on, but also what came before. It does take a village. Again, the bones are here for this to be sustainable, but we hope that people who read and who subscribe and who hear this feel like they can be a part of this too, whether it be through an internship, through pitching a story, you know, or writing a story. Yeah, we're interested in finding ways for a diversity of members of these six towns, community members can engage regardless of their background or, you know, where they come from.
You can read and subscribe to The Overlook at theoverlooknews.com. From Bob Dylan's White Room in Woodstock, New York, this is Brett Berry.
And you can hear the full Catskills podcast at catscast.com. That's K-A-A-T-S-C-A-S-T, the biweekly series featuring Catskills culture, history, sustainability, local interviews, and more. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Coach Maggie is here, moving toward health. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
Whether Radio Catskill brings a smile to your day, some inspiration, or a greater connection to the Catskills and Northeast PA, we're proud to be here with you. Federal funding, about $1.60 per person annually, helps keep these trusted services strong and accessible to everyone in our community. Learn how you can safeguard local public media stations like ours by visiting protectmypublicmedia.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Maggie Fitzpatrick is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. Her column is Moving Toward Health. It's out every Tuesday, and she's here with us to talk about it. This column, Maggie, healthy ways to consume caffeine. I have a bit of a bone to pick with you about this column.
Okay, I'm ready to hear it.
You mentioned the importance of waiting 90 minutes after waking up before consuming caffeine. I can't do it.
Oh, no.
Why do you say that?
Yeah, so we're going to talk about a couple different hacks, but the thing with caffeine is that whether it's good or bad, we're not going to talk about that today, okay?
It is
one of the most widely used, you could call it a supplement, right?
Yes.
It can help us feel more awake. And whether or not you decide to consume it is up to you. But if you do, we're going to talk about a couple different ways that we can make it a little bit more in line with wellness. And one of those ways is waiting 90 minutes after you wake up to consume it.
And there's some science behind this.
There is some science behind it. So the reason for that is caffeine actually blocks the, I'm forgetting the name, but the neurotransmitters that make us feel sleepy.
Okay.
Right. And so when you first wake up, you're actually, you don't have enough of them in your brain for the caffeine to block them to help you feel more awake. Right. And so I know it doesn't feel that way. Right. But actually what has happened is we've kind of like created a habit loop where we feel like we need it first thing in the morning more than the body actually needs it.
Right.
Right. And so if we can wait a little bit longer, then it actually becomes a little bit more effective. And in that time, it gives us time to do some of the other things that are healthy for us.
You also recommend eating food and drinking water before consuming caffeine. How do those simple actions help balance things out, like blood sugar and cortisol levels?
Yeah. So if we can wait a couple of minutes after waiting up, maybe we could consume some water and some food before having caffeine. And the ways that those things can help, number one, when we wake up in the morning, we're dehydrated, right? Mm-hmm. We haven't consumed any water for many hours. And so it's very beneficial for us to consume some water first thing in the morning. Caffeine is also slightly dehydrating to our body, right? So if we're consuming caffeine before we consume water in the morning, we're only perpetuating the fact that we are dehydrated. And so it's really beneficial if we can just consume a little bit of water first, then that will help our bodies feel well during the day while still having our coffee or whatever.
And we're talking about coffee here, but there are so many caffeinated beverages out there loaded with sugar, sodas, and other types of beverages that are caffeine-laced or laden. How can you make some healthier choices when it comes to those kind of caffeinated drinks without sacrificing your, you know, what you like to taste or your energy level that you're trying to achieve, I suppose?
Yeah, so I'll talk about food and this together.
Okay.
If we can eat food before we consume caffeine, that also helps. You mentioned cortisol levels before. Our cortisol levels, cortisol is, you know, what's released when we're experiencing stress, right? And if we're consuming caffeine before food, because we're dehydrated and because our body doesn't actually need it quite yet, it can increase our cortisol levels and it can make it so that way our blood sugar is not as balanced throughout the day, right? So if we can eat some food before we consume caffeine, then that will allow our body to regulate our blood sugars a little bit better. So that way we're not having moments of like bursts of energy and then crashes, right? We want to mitigate those high spikes in blood sugar and cortisol. And then when it comes to what type of caffeine we're actually consuming, like you mentioned, sugar is commonly paired with caffeine in our favorite drinks, right? And sugar, we've talked about sugar so many times, and I am not here to demonize it completely. However, there are a lot of ways where it sneaks into our diet, and it is wreaking havoc on our bodies.
You mentioned knowing the importance of your caffeine tolerance, you call it. What how can someone determine their like personal caffeine limit?
Yeah. Well, how do you know when you've hit your caffeine limit?
I think that I know based on experience from years ago where I would just like kind of always be consuming either coffee or a sugary beverage throughout the day. And I'd just be like wired. And then I realize I have to like lessen that. So now I limit that intake to just the coffee in the morning and I don't have any caffeine consciously throughout the rest of the day. Okay, I'll have a piece of chocolate or something.
Yeah,
but like,
yeah,
I'm not like having a beverage or
another
Coke or Pepsi or something like that, or these other caffeinated beverages. So I try to limit that time to just the morning.
Yeah, I think everyone's tolerance is a little different, right? There's obviously also different times of life where you should be consuming less caffeine. For example, if you're pregnant, right, you want to decrease caffeine intake a little bit. But I think it shows up differently for each person. So for me, my sweet spot is like between 100 and 150 milligrams of caffeine. Like if I consume that much, I'm like, okay, I feel more energized. I feel more awake. I'm not jittery. My stomach is not freaking out at this moment, right? I don't feel like my body physically starts to like shake a little bit, you know? And if I consume too much caffeine and I get to that point, I'm like, okay, well, maybe that was not a good decision, right? And so for me, that has been my sweet spot. I think if we can start to tune into how our body feels a little bit, right, when we are consuming certain things. So this goes back to reflection, right? Like, what did I eat today? What order did I eat it? And how did it make me feel? Then we can start to determine if what we consumed that day is beneficial for us or if we've pushed that limit too far.
I'm going back to the morning and coffee. I use a pour over coffee thing in the morning. So can I count the like 5 to 7 minutes it takes the water to boil and then the coffee to go through the filter as that 90 minutes?
I mean, it's definitely getting closer to 90 minutes, you know.
I will try. There are no guarantees, Maggie Fitzpatrick.
Maybe just like some eggs or something. Okay. I don't know what you eat for breakfast, but we could try.
We could try. Small steps. You're helping us adjust our caffeine levels and trying to do it in a healthy and balanced way. Maggie Fitzpatrick is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. The column is out today on newsstands or online, scdemocratonline.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, you can find all of our local programming on our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association, sullivancatskills.com, Catskill Brewery, brewing ales, lagers, and mixed fermentation beers in a LEED Gold certified building, plus a food truck and beer garden, at exit 96 off Route 17 in Livingston Manor, catskillbrewery.com. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, why does everyone hate rats?
We really hate them. We hate their success because their success feels like our failure.
And do rats really cause pandemics and plagues?
That's the one that most people think are the right one. They are wrong.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
On the next Radiolab, what if the answer to one of the world's oldest biological mysteries,
how do migrating birds navigate so well,
could only be found by taking our most complicated out of this world science?
This is where we go seriously off the rails into the deep sci-fi stuff.
Whoa.
And looked for it
somewhere inside the eye of a migrating bird.
That's on the next Radiolab.
Wednesday at 1 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Plentiful sunshine today, a high of 63, some wind gusts up to around 15 miles an hour. Cloudy tonight, a low of 29. And tomorrow, partly cloudy skies in the morning, becoming overcast in the afternoon, not as warm, high 46. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.